It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and emails on a conspiracy theory Thursday afternoon. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to be with you all over the Pacific Northwest, Idaho, Washington, Oregon, 21 stations, soon to be, we understand, 22, to really cover all three states. It is great to be with you. Your calls are welcome, and your emails and Facebook posts and Twitter comments and everything else. The subject of putting taxes on sugary drinks just gets under my skin. And maybe it shouldn't, because as a type 2 diabetic, I have to avoid sugar anyway. But there are all these cities. City of Seattle wants to do it. Portland wants to do it. Well, it's going to be put on the ballot, it appears, in the city of Portland. And they are proposing a 1.5 cents per ounce tax on sugary drinks. So if you're talking about a 32-ounce bottle of soda pop, about 50 cents in taxes, because the powers that be, our nanny state, has decided that we think sugar is bad for you. Well, I think sugar may be bad for you, may be good for you, but it is your decision. And I would also point this out, that while they propose to put this 1.5 cents per ounce tax on sugary drinks, they mean sugary drinks of the likes of Mountain Dew or Coca-Cola. They do not mean sugary drinks as in a lot of the sugary drinks that are sold by the likes of Starbucks. Imagine that. In the liberal Northwest, Starbucks being exempt from a sugary drinks tax. And why is that? Well, because wealthier people drink Starbucks and poorer people drink sugary soda pop. And those are actually real demographic data points. So why do you suppose the powers that be in liberal cities like Seattle and Portland and Eugene and other places like that would want to put a tax on poor people that is not paid by the rich people? I don't know. I'd love to ask them, because it doesn't make any sense. Nor does it make any sense that somehow you're going to keep people from drinking that soda pop. If they decide they want it, they're going to buy it and they're going to drink it. Anyway, it's a foolish proposal, but at least in this case, before Multnomah County tries to pry $28 million from some of its poorest residents through a tax on soda pop, it's likely to be put on the ballot. There is already an effort underway to gather the 17,000 signatures to put the measure before voters this coming November. And I have a feeling the voters are going to vote it down, especially when we start to harangue the liberal progressive politicians who say we want to tax the poor and not tax the rich. And if that makes sense to you, let me know why. Let's go to Tom in Bellevue listening on Talk Radio 570. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, sorry, Lars.
No worries.
I'm a little bit surprised at the way that everybody is approaching this argument over the lady with the two knives and the unfortunate shooting, you know, police having to shoot her. It's not a police overreaction issue. It's what it really is it's the unintended consequences of civil rights lawsuits filed back in the 60s by the ACLU.
Yep.
Back in the 60s, they filed a lawsuit on behalf of the civil rights of mentally ill people and having them committed to facilities that basically the ruling was if they can feed themselves and clothe themselves and do not prove an imminent safety danger to themselves or someone else, they can't be committed or they can't hold them. And this kind of thing is the result of that situation. If this lady was mentally whatever, you know, through drugs or whatever the situation was, in all likelihood, had that lawsuit not been filed, she probably would have been forced to receive some sort of medical attention through being committed or whatever. And this situation, in all likelihood, probably wouldn't have happened. She'd still be here. The officers wouldn't be in trouble for this. And you know, we probably wouldn't even be talking about this.
No, I agree with you, Tom. And think about this. You know, there are a lot of people who want to put releasing folks from mental institutions on the back of Ronald Reagan when he was governor of California. The truth is, if you go back and read the history, as I have, that they began releasing people because of those lawsuits 10 years before Reagan even became governor of California. But he's become sort of the bad guy to point to. And they say, well, he defunded these institutions. Well, he defunded them because the civil rights, civil commitment laws, as you point out, were liberalized to say you could be as crazy as you want to be as long as you're not a danger to yourself or others.
Exactly.
And what, to me, this is almost mean-spirited on the part of those people who say they advocate for civil rights. And here's why I say that. You tell somebody you can be crazy. You can live in your own filth. You can sleep outside in the worst kind of weather, hot or cold. You can be without food. You can be without shelter. You can be without all those things. And we'll let you be exposed to disease and all kinds of things. And then only when you get just dangerous enough that we can say that you're a danger to yourself or others, do we lock you up? And then usually only for 72 hours or maybe in some cases for as much as a week or so. And the minute you get sort of leveled out, enough leveled out that you're not a danger anymore, we're going to kick you back on the streets and let you go through the whole cycle over and over and over again, like some twisted, perverse version of Groundhog Day, where you go through that cycle. Now, wouldn't it be kinder to people to say to them, in some cases, if you're not doing right by yourself, and again, I don't like the nanny state, but we're not talking about soda pop or cigarettes or things like that.
No, we're not.
We're talking about you are so crazy, you will sleep on the in the gutter in your own filth until you are in danger of dying, and then we'll pull you right back from the abyss of dying just enough that you're just not quite ready to either kill yourself or somebody else, and then we're going to kick you right back out, and we know to a fair certainty that you're going to be right back in the same place fairly quickly. Now, to me, that sounds like some kind of scheme that was engineered by a torture master who said, let's find the meanest way we can treat mentally ill people in our society. I know. Let them be crazy. Let them run in traffic. Let them put their lives at risk. But only when they get to that very edge of the razor do we pull them back. And then we let them do it again. It's like a cat playing with a mouse. You know, the cat lets the mouse go. The mouse thinks I'm free. He gets 2 feet away and the cat grabs him again and pulls him back. If you did that with an animal, people would lock you up for doing that to an animal.
I know it.
But if you do it to your mother or your aunt or your sister or someone else, they say, well, you have to respect the civil rights of that person to be as crazy as they want to be until they're right at death's door. And then we're only going to pull them back far enough that they'll survive for another couple of weeks and let them do it all over again. That's not a compassionate society, is it?
No, not at all. And like I said, I just can't believe that everybody is so, well, I can believe it because, you know, police, right now it's hip to say the police are overreacting, the Black Lives Matter movement and all that stuff has demonized them so bad that when you say, oh, the police gunned down this poor woman, you know, she was only 78 pounds. Yes, she had two big kitchen knives, you know, whatever. But, you know, oh, this poor woman, the police overreacted. That grabs headlines, grabs attention, sells papers, and gets people to click on the websites. But, you know, I just am shocked that nobody is talking about the fact that this and all the other scenarios like it, we hear about it probably once a week. Some mentally unstable individual is shot by a police officer, you know, because they came after the police officer with a knife or a gun or a pointed stick or whatever. And nobody brings up the fact that it's a direct correlation to the lawsuits filed by the ACLU. If you want to point the finger at anybody, point it at the irresponsible, perpetual lawsuits filed by the ACLU and the unintended consequences of their short-sighted action.
Let me offer you two suggestions. The first suggestion is we need to change those civil commitment laws, and I've been talking about that on this program for 20 years now, literally.
Yes, sir, you have.
Second situation, and here's one where an awful lot of the people who have these mental illnesses, they're mental illnesses that are addressable with pharmaceuticals. They're not a cure-all, but they can keep the person from being a danger to themselves and others and maybe allow. But here's the downside to them. Everyone who takes them, and I've talked to people who take them, will tell you, I don't like the way it makes me feel. It may make them fuzzy-headed. It may upset their stomach. It makes them feel not right. But it's keeping them alive and able to live a productive, normal life. So here's what I would suggest. Since most of those people are on some form of public assistance, usually SSI disability, perhaps Social Security, food stamps, subsidized housing, etc., here's what I've proposed, and I don't think it's undoable. You say, we'd like you to stay on your meds. And the person says, well, I'm not going to. I'm going to quit taking them whenever I feel like it. You say, that's fine. But as long as you're on the system and you're getting support from the system, we're going to dole your money out the resources that we give you out, you know, in small dribs and drabs, a couple of days at a time. So if you're entitled to $900 a month in disability, that's about 30 bucks a day, right? So we're going to fund your ATM account. And as long as you go in and take your meds, the account stays turned on. And the minute you decide to go off your meds, the account turns off. Now, the three things I've found in life that motivate most human activity on planet Earth are money, sex, and power. All right? So let's take the money angle, since you can't use the other two. You don't have any power over a crazy person. And you say to them, the money is only going to show up in the account if you take your pills. And people have said to me, well, how would you get them to take their pills? And I said, well, if they're able to work a job, then at your workplace, maybe there's an arrangement where your boss can say, you need to come in and take your pills every day. Is that a little extra trouble for your boss? Sure. But, you know, if the boss is compassionate, he's going to say, fine. The day that, you know, the employee Jane or Joe decides not to take their pills and not show up at work, he picks up the phone and calls a number, or better yet, sends a text message or an email and says, you know, Lars has dropped off his meds again. And at that point, Lars knows his ATM is going to get shut off. And all the other resources as well. I figure that, like, money motivates everybody. People avoid parking tickets because they're 50 bucks. People will avoid dropping off their meds because they know that their resources are going to be cut off. And if you say, well, that's not fair, of course it's fair. You're on a public system. The system has requirements, and there are all kinds of requirements for parole, for probation, for welfare, for food stamps. One of the requirements is, if you're mentally ill and we can address those problems through medication, if you decide not to take the medication, then you're deciding not to comply with the, you know, the criteria of that program. Now, if that kept a few more schizophrenics on their meds and out of trouble and out of danger, I think it'd be worth doing. Thanks for the call. Back in a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and emails. My old friend Terry Emmer joins us now. Terry, how are you doing? I understand your company has won some big prizes.
Yeah, we're doing great, Lars. And we just came back from a convention in Arizona where we competed with 46 countries, and we were very fortunate to win the hauling job of the year, and then we won the rigging job for lowering the Selwood Bridge, and then won another one, so we won the Triple Crown, so it was a great year.
People need to understand that Emmert International moves some of the largest objects on planet Earth, bar none, a million-pound rock that was moved to the L.A. Art Museum. You offered to move the space shuttle, but they gave it to some foreign competitor of yours. But what was, you got the one prize for moving the Selwood Bridge and taking the old one down. What was the other job for, the rigging job? Describe that one.
Oh, that was a big press that we set back in Illinois, and it's the largest press in the Western Hemisphere. Oh. And we had to move parts of it from Canada, parts from Texas, and put it on our transporters and put it on rail cars, and we had to barge it, and then we had to put it back on rail car, then back on transporters, and then moved it in and set it in the plant.
Now, how big was that thing?
Well, the heaviest lift of the pieces was 1,627,000 pounds. It was over 3 million pounds fully assembled.
What were they printing with that? They weren't printing newspapers, were they?
No, it's a press. They press all sorts of components, like the front of submarines. It presses...
the front of submarine? You mean the rounded part of the front of the submarine?
Yes.
And they're using this press to press that out of solid metal.
Yes, they do.
So you had to move that one as well. So that was the big rigging job. What was the other project?
The other one was moving the ET-94, the only fuel cell left in the world for the space program. And we moved that from New Orleans down through the Panama Canal. And then coming up the Mexican coast, a ship had sunk, and we rescued the survivors and headed on into San Diego, dropped off the survivors, and then delivered it to Marina Del Rey, and then moved it 18 miles over the road into the new museum.
All right. Now, and I take it you've got all your difficulties worked out with all the regulatory agencies that you have to deal with all the time.
how optimistic are you?
Well, I'm very optimistic in the Trump year, but I know that you have your share of disputes with some of the you know, because people say dogs bark, ducks quack, and regulators regulate. And I know that you have your fair share of regulators who are constantly crawling all over your operation trying to find something wrong, right?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of it, you know, when you try to develop things and you have a lot of projects going, there's just a lot of bureaucracy that you have to go through, and a lot of wasted time on a lot of this. We need some more deregulation, because we need to have that attitude like you and I talked about when you come to Portland or Clackamas County and Multnomah County. We like to hear the words, how can we help you get your project done, instead of, let me throw about 100 roadblocks and see if you still want to be here in the state of Oregon.
I was going to say, and you know, the whole country is suffering from this. I like President Trump's approach that he says if anybody writes a new regulation, they have to first get rid of two similarly large other regulations. And if we did that for a while, we could pare this down to something sensible.
Well, to be honest with you, I can say that Clackamas County this last year has been a remarkable improvement, and I do see a lot more cooperation.
Well, I was going to say, Terry, before we run out of time, you're really impressed with the latitude which the regulators have had toward the new housing over by the Moda Center where the Blazers are housed.
Yeah, I think that's quite impressive. We can have all of our fans, people that come from out of town, and they can come and see the great housing project right next door to the Moda Center.
For the bums.
You know, maybe the less unfortunate, but I mean, I think we need to give them opportunities. We need to give them jobs, not a free ride.
Well, it just amazes me that they put all these roadblocks in your way to try to move houses from point A to point B to save real housing while they're building little garden sheds for people to live in who used to live on the street.
Well, yeah, we've got four buildings that are sort of what you might call tiny homes. Really small homes are going to be very much in demand, and we're trying to bring them from Salem, Oregon to Clackamas, which is really very simple, and I cannot believe how long it's taken us. I'm hoping that everybody sort of starts working together so that we can provide that affordable housing
for
people who want to pay for it.
Terry, you need to start including homeless in the description of every one of your projects, and maybe you'll get more done. Terry Emmert from Emmert International, you've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Don't forget, tomorrow, First Amendment Friday, and I'll be doing it from my favorite gun store, Northwest Armory, so that should be a lot of fun. Oh, and by the way, tonight on KGW, that's the NBC affiliate, Channel 8, I'm going to be doing my regular weekly face-off. We call it Left Hook, Right Jab with Steve Novick. And it should be interesting. We're going to do the health care bill and the latest Senate version that has come out today, even though there are now four Republican senators who oppose it. And there are four of the more conservative members of the U.S. Senate who are saying they're not going to do it. The Republicans cannot afford to lose four votes and still win in the Senate. They can only afford to lose two votes. Let's go to Mary in Almsville. Hey, Mary, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Hi, Lars. Thanks for your show. I wanted to touch on the gun knife topic.
Yeah.
One thing that people may not appreciate that I certainly learned is years ago when I was taking my concealed carry class and other shooting classes was to be aware of my surroundings. And there's a thing called Tooler's Law or drill, you may have heard of it, is that a person can cover 21 feet in 1.5 seconds. And we did some drills where we would stand at a start line and they would time us and we would run 21 feet.
Yeah.
And then they did the same thing for shooting. And as a middle-aged woman at the time and a pretty good shot, I could physically run cover 21 feet faster than I could draw and shoot accurately.
Yep.
And that was under a low-stress situation.
Mary, we have brought up the 21-foot rule a number of times in the few days we've been talking about this, not only the shooting that happened over the weekend in Seattle of the woman who had the two knives in her hands, but I first encountered that when I went through a citizens academy with the local police department. And they said, we'll show you examples where, you know, an officer, and they'll do drills where they actually put a rubber knife in the hand of the would-be assailant, and then they have the officer pretend to be the officer confronting this person, and the person has the knife concealed, and then they start to cover that 21 feet, and the officer is told, draw your weapon once you've identified that the person is coming at you with a weapon, and try to line up for a shot, and invariably, the person with the knife gets within arm's reach of the officer before the officer can draw and develop a target solution. And that means you're what folks seem to be asking for, the ones who object to shooting somebody who presents this kind of threat, is they're asking for more dead cops and more dead civilians.
Exactly, Lars. I think people need to appreciate the situation and how little time it takes for a lot of action to happen.
Absolutely right. Mary, thanks a lot for the call. By the way, there's a new study out today that I wanted to mention. It's an insurance study that links increased car crash claims to legalized pot. The Highway Loss Data Institute, which is a leading insurance research group, says the study results released today show that collision claims in Colorado, Washington, and Oregon are up 2.7% in the years since legal recreational marijuana sales began compared with surrounding states. Legal recreational pot sales in Colorado began in January 2014, 6 months later Washington, and in October 2015, Oregon. They say, we believe the data is saying that crash risk has increased in these states, and these crash risks are associated with the legalization of marijuana. So, if you are a non-marijuana smoker or a marijuana smoker in Oregon or Washington, get ready for your car insurance rates to go up, because that's exactly what this says. If the insurance companies have to pay out more in losses, they are going to collect those losses, whether you smoke pot or not. The liability increases, and they got to get the money somewhere. Let's go to Ronnie in Kennewick. Ronnie, thanks for listening on KONA. Welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Thank you, sir. Just wanted to say that you are my favorite talk show host.
Thank you.
I never have disagreed with you on anything, and I think you hit it on the nail every time.
Thanks.
You're welcome. My issue is with the lady with the knife. How could anybody think that that is not a danger, regardless of if it's a woman or not? I mean, how do you know what her intentions are going to be? I mean, of course you're going to use deadly force if you feel your life is a danger.
I agree with you. And frankly, I've seen some small women and small men. Again, ride-alongs are a great way to observe this. Small women and small men who've had two or three officers required to be able to restrain them effectively. So when you say, well, she's only 78 pounds and she's got the physical stature of a woman rather than a man, that does not necessarily protect you. Let's go to Tom, who's a naysayer. Hey, Tom, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, Lars. Say, I've got a little different perspective on this.
Hey, Tom, are you on a speakerphone by any chance?
Let me take it off.
Yeah, please do, because otherwise you sound like you're talking to us from Mars. What's on your mind?
Okay. I believe that police should be held accountable for overreacting to perceived threats when on occasion they do. So
Before we go further, can you tell me the difference between a perceived threat and a real threat? Give me an example of each.
Okay. In my case, the perceived threat consisted of a public records request, which would document police wrongdoing. Officer Cartwright responded by attempting yet failing to arrest me. He even staked out my...
Hold on. He tried to arrest you for filing a public records request. I got to know how that happened.
That's correct.
Well, hold on. You walked in and you asked for a public record, and they arrested you for asking for a public record and doing nothing else.
No, he came to my place of business the next day after he found out that I made the public records request.
Yeah.
And the way of getting out of responding to the public records request was opening up a case against me. And in order to follow through on that, he came out to my place of business and tried to arrest me.
What did he try to arrest you for? What was the charge?
Obstruction of justice.
By doing what? You know, you're leaving something out that the audience needs to know. No, it couldn't be just filing the public records request. What was the charge?
Because
there is no such criminal charge to arrest somebody on called filing a public records request. On the other hand, if you were trying to intimidate a witness, so why? anytime someone deliberately leaves something out of a story like that, Tom, it's usually to benefit their telling of the story. So
okay,
why don't you be honest?
Let me tell you the whole story. I didn't know how much time you wanted.
Well, yeah. You've wasted a lot of time at this point. Story. Tell me what the actual charge was that he arrested you for.
Well, he didn't arrest me because I wasn't at my place of business. And when I reported his activities to his supervisor, the supervisor shut the whole thing down. But what happened was, is I originally had filed a police report on an employee for stealing employment records from me. The officer came out and didn't want to get involved with it because it was too much work for him. He felt it was a civil
case. How do you know what he felt?
I know what he felt because he told me this is a civil case. And I said, no, it isn't. When somebody comes in and steals records from a business, it's a criminal case. And so I intimidated him on that. And he went ahead initially, but then he decided that he wasn't going to file on that. And when I was upset that he didn't file on it, then I filed a public records request to get the information to see why he didn't file on it. And his response was to come out after me the next day.
He came out to talk to you because he couldn't have been trying to arrest you because you weren't there.
No, he was trying to arrest me.
For what?
He called me up on the phone.
No, but
what happened was that...
Okay, Tom, unless you're going to tell me what charge he was going to charge you with, I'm not going to continue the conversation. So tell me what the
tampering with evidence because I made copies of the employment records that the other employee had stolen.
Well, hold on, they're your records, right?
They're my records.
And there was no okay, Tom, email me on it. I'll be glad to take a look at it. Let me go to Randy in Spokane. Randy, thanks for listening on KXLY. What's on your mind?
You bet, Lars. About the sugar tax that you were talking about with the drinks, do you know, just in general, do these sin taxes, do they ever replace other taxes?
No, very rarely. Very rarely.
Okay, then are they pegged for some certain cause or?
Yeah, well, what they'll usually do is they'll say, we want the soda tax. In this case, in Multnomah County's case, they want $28 million from the poorest people in the county, in general, who drinks sugary soda pop. And they say they will spend it on children's programs, which could be, that's a definition broad enough you could do almost anything with the money and say we're spending on children's programs. They want $28 million to drop into the hopper that they can spend on programs that are mostly feel-good programs. Now, some might actually have some value. I'll allow that. But they want $28 million. It's not replacing another tax. It's to create new programs and hire more employees to do things. And they'll be able to point them and say, well, we have this after-school program, or we have this other program. But ostensibly, they're doing it for the children. Because, you know, Randy, anytime a politician is challenged on something, you want to raise taxes. Well, I'm doing it for the children. You want to put more limitations on the liberties of American citizens? I'm doing it for the children. I'm doing it for the children can cover just about anything.
All right. Okay. Well, let's assume that, you know, the constituency's on board with that.
I doubt it, but yeah. Oh, I doubt it. When it goes to a vote, I think it's going to go down hard at the polls.
Okay. Well, my second question then would be just a little bit of a question for you, I guess, is that even though the demographic might show that it goes to people of lower incomes, isn't it fundamentally these sin taxes? Aren't they still the choice of the person making the purchase? And in that sense, we really don't care.
Well, toilet paper could be a choice of the person. You could put a tax on toilet paper. It would hit almost everybody equally. And you could say it's your choice to buy toilet paper or not. I mean, almost anything could be a choice. You could say coffee is a choice because human beings can exist without coffee. I wouldn't feel very human if I got through the day without a cup of coffee or two in the morning. But you could say and coffee would hit a much broader spectrum of people from rich to poor. And that's my objection is that if you put on an income tax, everybody who makes income pays it. If you put on a property tax, which both Oregon and Washington have, it hits almost everybody equally because whether you own a house or rent a house, you're paying property taxes. But when they go out and say, let's target this one little group, one of the motivations for doing it that way is that if you're going to take a vote of the group and you're only going to hit one small section of the group with the tax, then you have a greater chance of having it not be defeated at the polls. If you go home and tell your family, if you had a family of five at home and you go home and you say, we're going to have some changes around here. We're no longer spending money on Johnny's baseball team. We're not going to let him play baseball this year. We're not going to buy him a uniform. And it only hurts Johnny. And the other four people are not touched by that change. And then you have a family vote on it. How do you think it's going to go?
Okay, so would you are you arguing then that the group affected by this is relatively a non-voting group?
No, well, they are. Poorer people don't tend to vote as reliably unless they're older poorer people. Older people tend to vote the most reliably of any demographic group in America. So you have a group of people who are economically less powerful. They have fewer connections. They give less money, far less money to political campaigns, which is another criteria for politicians. They don't like to hit people who vote for them. So you see a tax that's slapped on in Seattle where they say, we're going to slap all the poor people who drink sugary soda pop, and we're not going to hit the people who drink Starbucks lattes for $4 a pop. And in general, that's going to hit the people who don't give money to political campaigns and not hit the people who do give money to political campaigns. I mean, it's very mercenary on the part of the politicians. They are not going to hurt themselves or the people who give them money. They're happy to hurt everybody else.
Okay, so last question. Fundamentally, do you think what's really behind these sin taxes is just a way to get taxes for other things that they can then brag their constituents about?
Yep.
Okay, so you don't think fundamentally it's to, like, increase the health, general health of the population?
No, because I got to tell you, I used to work with a guy who every morning on his way to work at 4 in the morning, because he was an assignment editor, bought a 64-ounce soda pop. You put on the tax Multnomah County is proposing, it's an extra dollar for his soda pop. Do I believe that he would stop buying that 64-ounce tankard of soda pop, because it went up by a buck? No. I think he's going to view it as one of those things. This is part of his morning routine. Is it going to take another dollar out of his pocket? Absolutely. Will it stop him from doing it? Of course not. I mean, cigarettes in New York City cost $13.50 a pack, and people still smoke in New York City. Now, you say, well, if we raise the price high enough, they'll stop. Well, if you get it to $40 a pack, yeah, probably.
Well, just fundamentally, though, I'm not sure your response is, on point exactly.
Well, they're trying to take money from a group for whatever it is that the county wants to spend it on, and they're trying to hit the group least likely to vote them out of office.
But they're willing to pay it. That group's willing to pay
it. Well, then put it on toilet paper. It'll hit everybody. But then again, everybody would object to it. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. David Cross joins us each and every week to give us an update on the doings of illegal aliens in the Northwest. David, welcome back. What's going on this week?
Lars, we did our Oregon Department of Corrections Foreign National Sex Crime Report. And it was picked up by the Washington Examiner and Fox Nation and also the AP. And there were 461 criminal aliens in the Oregon Department of Correction prison system for sex crimes like sex abuse, rape, and sodomy. So that's 83% of those individuals were Mexican national. And the AP story actually utilized it in relationship to House Bill 3464. That's the legislation that the Democrats passed in the House that would cover up the identities of illegal aliens in Oregon. And maybe you can expand on that.
No, I'll tell you what. Oregon wants to become even more of a sanctuary state than it already has been, having passed that law that you and I have talked about so many times over the years back in the mid-1980s to say that police agencies aren't allowed to inquire into your immigration status if you're not accused of some other crime. But, of course, even the police agencies in the Northwest, like those in Oregon, choose to expand that to say, we're just not going to ask you about your immigration status at all, even if you are accused of a crime. So the fact that they now want to double down on sanctuary city status or sanctuary state status for the state is absolutely crazy. David, thanks for the update. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show on the Northwest Radio Network.